Okay, I hope this works. Let's see. All right.
Okay, well, my name is Jamal Batts, member of the Black Aesthetic, and we'd like to thank Steve Dickinson, Steve, for inviting us here, and we're happy to be here at San Francisco State with you tonight. So I'm going to give a little intro on the Black Aesthetic and kind of talk about our publication a bit. So for us, the Black Aesthetic, we've termed it with this an acronym TBA, meaning to be announced, to be assessed, and to be actualized. Thus, the Black Aesthetic is a position of the yet to be announced. We eschew continuity in favor of exploration. In an interview for Film Quarterly, Michael Gillespie says, "I'm interested in the rendering of blackness, or how black visual and expressive culture stages race, not just as impermeable fact, but as multidimensional and multidiscursive." The Black Aesthetic is not interested in the already expressed face of the race, but on the multidimensional visual and expressive culture of blackness. This objective is not to clarify a theme as such. Instead, we are unambiguously creating a space where various distinct and dissonant black artistic expressions can live. Our most consistent venture thus far has been an Oakland-based biannual 8-week film screening series featuring the works of indie, experimental, unknown, or, to our mind, underappreciated black filmmakers. These screenings are followed by in-depth exchange, often with the filmmaker, about the ways in which the themes of the films and their varied temporalities intersect with the current proliferation of black aesthetics and the structural forces that interdict black life. As member Layla Wiafoe has recently noted, the film screening is not a novel idea, but as a collective, the black aesthetic distinguishes itself by documenting this experience through photography and the publication of varied visual, poetic, biographic, and scholarly responses to the film screened. The group has also curated one-off screenings and discussions at cultural and academic institutions, as well as collaborated with visual artists. Being that the group considers itself to be announced, the Black Aesthetic acts as a container for its members' growing collaborative aesthetic desires, experimenting with different Oakland environments while refusing to land on a place, a genre, a mode of curation that would define its entangled object of study, blackness. The Black Aesthetic's members are Jamal Batts, hello, Ryan Austin Dennis, Ra Malaika Imhotep, and Layla Wiafoe. And tonight, we'll give a preview of the work in our second publication, which you see here. It is on sale tonight, a few copies, if you're interested. And we'll have presentations by some of those who are within its pages. So our readers tonight will be Christian and also Layla, Ishmael Muhammad, Ryan Austin Dennis, and me. All right. So look forward to speaking with you tonight.
How's everybody doing? Everybody's good? My piece is really succinct, and so I'm going to talk a little bit and give a little bit of context about kind of the preoccupations and obsessions that I had regarding the spell that I wrote. The piece is accompanied by a piece of lynching photography, and I'll actually read the liner notes for it. It's this image used for this piece is the scorched corpse of William Stanley of Temple, Texas in 1915. The stage is from a photo print postcard inscribed in ink on the reverse side of the postcard. This is the barbecue we had last night. My picture is to the left with a cross over it, your son Joe. And so for quite a few years, I've been kind of obsessed with the idea of lynching photography, both its social and epistemological ramifications, but also like artistically, these actual images. I find them like incredibly haunting and also incredibly beautiful, and that kind of corresponds to like one of my personal like mantras or understandings about black life and black art, which is Black people can intrinsically see both the pain and the beauty in something simultaneously. And that's kind of why we create such dope shit. But with this image, what's so hauntingly beautiful about it is this guy, even in death with a charred body, kind of is in this triumphant pose over, you know, these white people who created or committed this atrocious act against him. So it's incredibly complex, incredibly nuanced, really hard to look at, but something that everybody should confront and also see that there is some like beauty in images like this, even though it's hard to like find that. Also, I'm really interested in the mythos of the African-American South, like post-antebellum. And I came across these spells that Zora Neale Hurston had compiled, which had previously only been passed down orally. And there were spells for like killing somebody, conjuring the devil, how to get out of jail, how to make somebody fall in love with you, how to make somebody have sex with you. Really, really interesting and sometimes incredibly dark things also kind of existing within that pain and beauty. And I was thinking like it would be really interesting to kind of like hijack that those spells and kind of create something that dealt with this pain and this beauty, or how to create that in art. So with that being said, I'll just read my very short piece. Take a knife and hold it to the fire until red hot. Dig a hole in your chest the size of a grown man's fist. Probe deeply. Play close attention and draw near to the things that scar and disturb you. Excavate equal parts pain and alienation. Mix in five parts joy and exploration. Let it fester in a dessert bowl. So.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Layla Weefer, or as my my co-member said, Weefway. I'd like to offer up both pronunciations because there's an internal family feud about how to pronounce the name. So either way is right. I'm going to read a piece from our publication as well, titled The Dialectics of Black Space. I typically like to do a deconstructed visual performance for this. So this is the first time I'm actually reading it from a book. But one thing I will continue to do is ask that the lights be turned off. I just have an affinity for drama and the dramatic, so. And also the piece is accompanied by this idea of darkness. I'll start with a quote from Arthur Jaffa. Just because a black person sings, don't make it black music. It wasn't until this recent trip to Los Angeles that I began a serious inquiry around the dialectics of black space. While visiting a variety of physical spaces, I observed critically so as to dissect the insider-outsider dynamics of blackness, its culture, its history, its imagery, and the faces standing in the shadows of its ownership. At a crucial moment where matters of black being feel like an incumbent visitor in the art world, I naturally side-eye most anything that feels misleading. While my crucial lens should adhere to the same criticism, I struggle with my own ability to empathize with and relate to art that uses the black image as capital, be it social or monetary, when it doesn't rest in the hands of a black artist. Black space is supposed to be a place of comfort, a home, a shelter preserving black intimacy. a place where our relationships to one another's blackness is bound. But as blackness shifts with time and amendment to language, so will the thing that houses it. Can you tell me what blackness sounds like? How loud is it? How quiet is it? Does blackness have the ability to abstain from sound? Can blackness simulate silence? Think about for just a moment the silence of darkness. Think about what that silence feels like. Blackness knows silence. There's nothing more silent than darkness. Nothing produces vibrato like darkness. Darkness occupies both inside and outside spaces, spaces that are both tactile and psychological. Spaces serve contradictory feelings of intimacy and isolation, depending on whether you're positioned as an insider or an outsider. A friend once told me, to be wise is to be able to hold space for contradiction. I would argue the same applies for blackness. In understanding blackness in the imagined space that blackness provides and claims, an insider can easily become an outsider, as an outsider through active engagement and consumption can become an insider. This is similar to the feelings that surfaced around Martinez's black-owned work. When it comes to matters of presenting concepts of blackness, I found that the outsider is often looking for simplification in place of nuance, and what they discover is a smokescreen. Space is not only high, it's low. It's the bottomless pit. There's no end to it. It's Sun Ra. Consider for a moment sitting in a movie theater, a space that capitalizes on darkness, a space which historically does not and cannot function without the absence of light. In the absence of light, physical attributes are less discernible. Our colors mute and blend. The bumps and curves in our figures blur. And all that's left is our breath, movement, and the tension that floats in the negative spaces our bodies can't fill. In darkness, it's hard to distinguish your pain from mine. I was recently at the Roxy, a historical film theater in the Mission District of San Francisco, watching Sun Ra's experimental jazz film, Space is the Place. If you've seen this black avant-garde visual think piece, then you are aware of its black propagandist narrative. If not, there are several fragments on YouTube that offers a taste of what it's like to experience in 1974 Oakland through a speculative narrative about the state of blackness. Through Sun Ra's vision, blackness is astral. Blackness is a radical elsewhere. A surreality that has an inadvertent existence on Earth. There are a few instances when I'm watching a film in the Bay Area where the space isn't dominated by a sea of mostly non-black, non-POC faces. The act of watching cinema in its traditional format, a dark theater with a larger-than-life-size screen and rows of seats, can be both a reclusively intimate act or one that engages the intimacies of sharing emotional and psychological space with community. Both acts occur in the dark. But again, conundrum and horror were watching in the seats directly next to mine as the credits rolled and the house lights revealed that I was the only black face in the audience. I was watching arguably one of the blackest films in perhaps the whitest space. Sun Ra's mission in Space is the Place is to build a black colony on Saturn. Is black space meant to be something we have to colonize or even recolonize? At a time where the ownership of blackness is at stake, is there and can there be such a thing as black space? A space that is meant for only black identified bodies to congregate? Who are the trespassers? What space are we trying to recolonize? Is it one that is rightfully ours? And if so, how do we know when a space belongs to Blackness? Does one ever? I like to think about Black space as a place that comfortably operates between the celebration of Black idioms and the subversion of Black epithets. A place where any form of nigga is acceptable as an underpinning of Black camaraderie. To have a Black aesthetic, to be in conversation with the Black aesthetic, and the Black aesthetic itself is an act of initiating and participating in that internal question and interrogation of Blackness. Its existence is to consider the possibilities of Black space by constructing it in real time and deconstructing it in printed matter. The answers will shift as much as the questions the answers attempt to serve until that matter decomposes with the English language. And I'll end with a quote from Fred Moten. To frequent, to gather, to solemnize in joy, to enjoy, to assemble in disassembly, to be quietly populous. Did you get one of yours? That's so fucked up. You gotta get one before we leave. Oh.
I'm Ishmael Muhammad. Am I speaking to this or to this?
Both.
Okay. I'm Ishmael Muhammad. I'm a writer and critic over in Oakland. I have a story in the second issue of The Black Aesthetic that its members were kind enough to publish. It's titled 13 Ways, an Occasional Story. It's a kind of series of flash fictions that I began writing in 2014. As I began thinking about ways to narrate Black boys' deaths at the time in a way that didn't foreground or sensationalize or trivialize, you know, those Black boys' bodies or kind of foreground Black suffering. And what I hit upon was a kind of adaptation of Wallace Stevens' poem 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, which if you've read it, it's like this like set of 13 almost haiku detailing the various ways in which this figure of the blackbird is kind of the underpinning of Stevens's world. And I thought it was interesting because while Stevens was notorious for hating Black people, he once called Gwendolyn Brooks a coon at the National Book Awards. He's a kind of northern patrician guy, just hated Black people and Jews. But he couldn't help but foreground this figure of the kind of like itinerant, like fugitive blackbird in this poem. And I could never help but read it as being like a symbol of like the Black body and the way in which this thing like underpins his entire world, his entire existence. And so I was kind of entranced by this like fugitive, but like somehow central figure that makes up all of like the white supremacist world. And it seemed like a powerful thing to kind of take those small poems and remake them and to make what was a marginal figure kind of central to the piece. So I'm gonna read the six that are included. It's kind of an ongoing series, ongoing project. There are six that are included in this issue of the Black Aesthetic, and I'm gonna read about seven more. I call it a story. It probably is just a poem, but I insist on calling it a story. So the title is 13 Ways, an Occasional Story. One, it was Beverly Hills in the summer, and so of course they sat at marble tables beneath the restaurant awnings with their heels tapping uncracked concrete. There were 20 people, customers, who appeared as naturally occurring objects, fixtures of the landscape. They looked so comfortable. Even when they moved, they were unmoving, like the ruins of a bridge that's collapsed into the river. From the kitchen, an eye in exile flitted from face to face, the only moving thing. Two. He has learned to operate as a loving mechanic in a field of leather straps clenched in various degrees of alarm at his presence, between two fields where his body is continuous with caressing fingers with leather grips, with a sustained swollenness if he is lucky, with silver sleek penetration if he is not. Circulating around three fields where pronouncing ask the right way can make all the difference, where pronouncing axe the wrong way can make all the difference, where giving up and not pronouncing ask at all can make all the difference. Three. Loving hands are for mashing sweet potatoes and cinnamon and vanilla and butter, because cake beaters leave that metallic trace, and also because when those same hands knead dough for dinner rolls, it's the transfer and trace of cinnamon that one desires. Four. He knows better than to consider himself one with any man or woman, and wouldn't desire anything like that. But you can be sure that if you've seen him in a room, he has already seen you, and has made, is making, has always made, will make the necessary adjustments. Five. His life has become a matter of breathing out, taking in, touching upon, sliding along, bumping against, curling around, slipping between, latching onto, lapsing into, innuendo. Six. For them, his body was a miracle, capacious enough to accommodate anything they might want to insert. He could absorb anything, and no insertion was too barbaric. In certain lights, they even detected the beginnings of a pleasure that veiled his face. A true miracle, that body, though when it was gone, it did not occur to them to wonder how they ever got along without it. Seven. This one's texture is smooth, frictionless, so fine that it slipped through memory's sieve. Still, every passage leaves a residue. So there's a golden bird that once perched astride a drive-through chicken shack on Slauson, its presence a bit of magic. His grandma entered the shack, tarried a while with the cashier, and returned a while later with bags of chicken, dark grease staining, stains speckling the white. Trash-strewn Slauson left little room for imagination, least of all for birds hopping truculent between the feet of thin, drug-addled men and women, all somebody's uncles, aunts, sisters, brothers, mothers, fathers, play cousins, god-nephews and god-nieces. How would they come? Alighting on unprotected pawn shop awnings or in the doorways of long-defunct public libraries? Eight. For him, there are no words without the spittle that accretes in the creases of full lips as thick tongues torture themselves into noble accents, contort themselves to be understood. No words without the contortions that coax meaning from voices that will themselves beyond sense. Nine. They would do anything to prevent him from slipping their embrace. Their fingers, tracing figures along the recess that was his body, mark the limits of their knowledge. 10. Outside of those he loves, few will ever catch sight of him turning in low light, back creasing, torso buckling under its own exertion, exalting in his own capacity for movement. To see him luxuriating, so turned inward, is enough to make the wretched cry out in euphony. 11. Those who stride so confidently over the earth. 12. He has waited and will always wait, recessed, an accumulation of glances, a mobile signifier, a patient craftsman amid the world's flotsam. Thank you.
My name is Ryan Austin. I'm a member of the Black Aesthetic. And I wrote three pieces. It's like a weird suite called Three Gestures on Blackness. And I'm going to read the first section, or part of the first section, until I get bored. Three Gestures on Blackness. An heir is not only someone who receives, he or she is someone who chooses and who takes the risk of deciding. That was from Jacques Derrida. And now we enter into a Black Nihilist manifesto. Nigger in a woodpile. A concealed motive or unknown factor affecting a situation in an adverse way. What is a slave an heir to? We arise in a world as a knot. Sartre says, it is as a knot that the slave first apprehends the master, and that there are even men whose social reality is uniquely that of the knot, who live and die having forever been only a knot upon the earth. As an heir to nothing, we, the new Niggerati, have decided to forego any teleology. You can't coerce the Niggerati. To streamline a concept is to economize. As unknown factors, we renounce art as a social force. How can nothing affect a situation? David Hammons is a nigger in a woodpile. One, I can't stand art, actually. I never, ever liked art, ever. I never took it in school. Black pleasure is a nigger in a woodpile. Quote, Black pleasure, not joy. What are its parameters? What are its primal sites? How does Black popular culture or Black culture in general address Black pleasure? How does it generate Black pleasure? Arthur Jaffa. Jacques Derrida is a nigger in a woodpile. Only, quote, only a finite being inherits, and his finitude obliges him. It obliges him to receive what is larger and older and more powerful and more durable than he. But the same finitude obliges one to choose, to prefer, to sacrifice, to exclude, to let go and leave behind, precisely in order to respond to the call that precedes him, to answer it and to answer for it, in one's name as in the name of the other. Jacques Derrida. William Pope L. is a nigger in a woodpile. I like to sell things at astronomical prices while fishing for humanity with the worm of the social unconscious. I'm a fisherman of the social absurd, if you will. I'm more provocateur than activist. My focus is to politicize disenfranchisement, to reinvent what's beneath us, to remind us where we all come from. And lastly, Kara Walker is a nigger in a woodpile. I fear that Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and all the rest were killed as proxies for the Black president. She wrote in an essay called Assassination by Proxy, said by a negress of noteworthy talent. You're up.
Testing. Can y'all hear me?
Cool.
My name is Sean Noor. I'm a writer. And I'm in the book near the end. My piece is about the Black woman as God. The Black woman as God is an exhibit that goes on in Oakland. And what I'm going to read is a free write that I used in preparation for writing this piece. It's in the longer version of the piece that was actually originally part of my master's thesis and part of my field research on queer Black feminism and Black women healers, one of which was Karen Seneferu, who's the curator of the exhibit. And then I'm going to read briefly from the background and introduction to the piece. And then the rest of the piece is there with photos. The room was brimming with Black women, each one buzzing slightly in her place, They came in many shapes, from thick, large women who were tall like the continent that birthed them. Some were slender, whose bodies wound beneath the fabric like hourglass. They came in many ages. The youngest body in the room was the autistic 8-year-old who sat beside me drinking soup in her mother's arms, while the eldest was a grandmother from New York, as I gathered from her accent that bit away at the R's at the end of her words. She sat directly in front of me. They came in many shades, from the light caramel queens to the freckled sisters with curly brown hair, to the chocolate mamas with smiles on their lips, to the dark-skinned goddesses who laughed heartily from the corners of the room. Only the black woman can say when and where I enter, in the quiet, undisputed dignity of my womanhood, without suing or special patronage. Then and there, the whole race enters with me. Anna Julia Cooper, 1892. Background: The Black Woman as God is an art exhibit that explores the representations of black women's divinity through the lens of black women reclaiming their ancestry, culture, history, and future. The brainchild of Karen Seneferu, this project had its second incarnation in 2016, featuring dozens of artists in several shows at different locations throughout the summer and fall. The curatorial project was led by a team that includes Karen, Sasha, Zakia, Idris, and many others, including volunteers and exhibited artists. As the team prepared for the first exhibit in Oakland, they held a series of meetings to help the participants get to know one another and to help plan and prepare for the exhibit. Introduction. I worked as a documentarian for the production of The Black Woman as God in 2016. I took field notes during the three planning meetings and conducted interviews with several of the black women participating in the exhibit. I attended the opening and recorded performances during the opening. These writings serve as a documentation of these gatherings in an effort to recall and retain the importance of a community and of sisterhood, in collaboration for social justice, ideological shifts, art, and of course, love. Toward this end, I interweave the words of Karen and the participants of the Black Woman as God exhibit, along with the theories of visual anthropology that serve as a framework for this collective project. The praxis of this project lives and thrives within these interactions, within these connections and translations. This paper also serves to explore the theoretical and epistemological contribution of Karen's film, Hot Comb, The Masquerade, to the field of visual anthropology and queer black feminism. Since first meeting Karen in 2015, I've heard her state the motto, her own motto, many times: space dictates meaning. With this adage in mind, my analysis of the relevant literature draws connections between the visual taking up of space and the ideological contribution of creating meaning for black women in art, history, and revolution. In this investigation, I utilize the concepts of visual activism, counter-visuality, and black aesthetics, as communicated by the Journal of Visual Culture, Nicholas Marizov, and Clyde E. Taylor, respectively. Where visual activism states that imagery and sight create ideology, counter-visuality posits that oppressed people can take control of the gaze, and black aesthetic postulates that we can reclaim the gaze and what it might look like. Each of these theories has a way of complicating and building upon one another within this paper and within the larger community dialogue, as we wrestle with the notions of agency and visual production. Karen's film, The Hot Comb Masquerade, proposes a right to look where none had existed. Through the use of visual aesthetics, visual activism, and the putting of counter-visuality into play, we shift the ideology and promote healing. Through dreamy vignettes of deities clothed from head to toe in vibrant tunics, fast-paced sequences of youth in mass spirits traversing the cityscape by bike and skateboard, and slow motion shots of caravans of gods in downtown Oakland, the film offers a look, a gaze, that aims to heal the wounds of colonialism. Hot Comb the Masquerade serves as a tool to heal the ideological wounds of black women and the black community at large by reclaiming visuality through our gaze, those who truly believe themselves to be God. This positionality is grounded in theoretical and historical frameworks, reaches beyond aesthetics and art, music, and performance. In doing so, the Hot Comb and the Black Woman as God serve as models for praxis an articulation of theory into action for collaborative curation towards social transformation. And I'll close with a quote that I was unable to source, but comes from one of the meetings. Somebody said it, so this person who quotes it attributes it to Spirit, so I will also attribute it to Spirit. Spirit says that we are to give from our overflow. We as Black women give from the bottom of our cup, and we are dying because of that. That is not going to happen anymore. I hope to give healing so that we have full cups that are spilling over and we can give from that. The Black woman is God. Anyone? Who's next?
All right, let me get this thing on. All right, okay, so again, my name is Jamal. Just a heads up, this piece is about anal. So if that's an issue for anyone, just let you know. Okay, all right. Happy to be with you again. Okay. So, and these are excerpts from my piece in the Black Aesthetic called Scratch and Sniff, Taste and See. Okay, so I'll start with that. Okay. So, a former lover once told me a story. In times of sorrow, for reasons unknown to me, thinking of it brings me joy. Once upon a time, a man came to his apartment to fuck. My former lover offered the gentleman some fish sticks. The man obliged. Later, as they were fucking, something smelled funny. The fucking stopped. The hungry visitor, on his hands and knees, looked back and said, "Oops, I shouldn't have had those fish sticks." On May 25th, 2017, the Black Aesthetic Film Screening Series convened to watch director Ali Logout's Lucid Noon Sunset Blush 2015, a short film about a motley crew of queer, mostly Black sex workers trying to make a living under a hot Texan sun. The day in the life of the crew that the film captures ends in the back of a pickup truck, where the most boisterous of the team's members, Dolly, played by Logout herself, addresses the rumor that she has a mango-flavored vagina. She proceeds to put her hand in her shorts and offer her comrades a taste of her finger. She warns, her vagina is a bit more savory this time of year. Each of her friends suck her finger in an impromptu bonding ritual. They all suck and agree, mangoes. During the post-film discussion for Lucid Noon, Ryan Austin Dennis asked if there's any equivalent to the film's genital sampling in men's social lives. At the time, I winced as my dirty little gay mind immediately flashed to a scene of men sipping on ass-flavored digits. But maybe that ain't so bad. Maybe it's just a little too close to home. Painting is a term used by Black queer communities to describe various levels of shitting during anal sex, presumably on accident. Truth be told, I can't verify the racial etymology of painting, because Black people can't have anything, but I can verify its derisive usage by Black gay men. It is a trusty form of bottom shaming, captured in sublimated and humorous phrasing such as, "Girl, he paints like Picasso." Thinking back, it was also a way for us, Black gay men, to deny our all-too-human capacity to shit. The racial grotesque is a concept laced with a deep shame at being Black and brown. I can remember, as a boy in elementary school, a little pale redhead of a white supremacist sitting behind me cross-legged, leaning forward and whispering softly in my ear that my skin was composed of shit. Something about the intimacy of that violation has stuck with me. As a child still trying to shape the myth of racial biology into some palpable truth, this was a painful message to carry. It is a memory, the shame of which I like to believe I have rid myself of through education or acts of respectability and protest. I now shrug it off every time it intrudes my mind. But as some sort of Black queer creative, I wonder if a similar
or shame keeps some of us from producing, watching, and writing down certain other stories? What pictures do we refuse to paint? And if we do decide to share, to confess, then why? Two black men are fucking each other ferociously on a white rug. Something smells funny. When they're done, one of them realizes he's left a brown spot on the carpet. There's no way to deny he's left his mark, like a dog. He curls into the fetal position on a couch in embarrassment. The other black man is surprised by his shock. He says, "Shit happens." In fact, shit has happened to him before. Lying on the couch, head bowed, embracing his own knees, the other black man is happy to hear that he's a dog too. The end. Thank you.